Thank you for joining us today, and welcome to Talk About with Rez and Andy, live every Monday at 3 p.m. I'm your host, Linda Rez, and I'm here with my co-host and great friend, Janie Andy Anderson. And welcome to Talk About with Rez and Andy. I'm your host, Linda Rez, and I'm here with my co-host, Janie Andy Anderson.
Hey, Linda, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Janie?
Good, really good.
Now, we're going to get right into our show today. Our show is about ALS, and specifically, we're going to be talking to a couple different guests, but the first one is the mom who is behind the $220 million ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, Nancy Frates.
Incredible woman.
Yeah, and her story I found to be one of the most life-changing interviews I've ever done. I came away, told everybody about it, but came away with a different perspective because of her son Peter's story. And we're just not going to waste any time. We're going to let Nancy tell us that story in her own words. And before we start, we are just very grateful that we had the opportunity to talk to her. After that interview, we're going to bring on a local executive director for our local chapter, Becky Moore. And we're going to talk more about the specific needs in these small communities and where your money is going when you do something like the Ice Bucket Challenge. But first of all, we're going to just go ahead and talk to Nancy. Hi, everyone. Our guest today is Nancy Frates, the mom behind the 2014 ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, which raised over $220 million. That's just amazing. The common name for ALS, the one we kind of know it by, is Lou Gehrig's disease. And 5,600 people in the U.S. are diagnosed with it every year, as was Nancy's son Peter in 2011. It's a terrible disease, and Nancy's here today to share her story, Peter's story, and the story behind the Ice Bucket Challenge. Thank you for joining us today, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Welcome,
it's my pleasure.
Well, how are you doing today?
We're doing well. Our days, we wake up and we see what the day will bring, and we just pull our bootstraps up and face it.
Mm-hmm. And is Peter there with you?
Peter actually lives in the home with us, with his wife and his baby, Lucy. Our community, when Pete was diagnosed, ran a fundraiser that allowed us to put a handicapped one-floor apartment onto our house for him and Julie, and then eventually they had Lucy. So the three of them live here with us.
Now, Nancy, Peter was diagnosed with ALS at the age of 27. How old is Peter now?
Peter just turned 30.
Okay.
And his diagnosis was exactly 3 years ago on March 13th.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about Peter's story?
Sure. Peter is the middle child of my husband and my three children. Our children grew up and all graduated college. So in 2010, my husband and I officially became empty nesters, and they all went to school in Boston. Two of them, my youngest son, Andrew, and Peter, both moved out into apartments in Boston, and my daughter, Jen, lived in Manhattan. And Peter had been, a pretty active child his whole life. He showed signs of athletic ability at a very early age and also leadership qualities at a very early age. And he grew up through the ranks playing three sports. His favorite sports to play were football, hockey, and baseball. So starting at age six, he played all three of those sports and continued right up through high school. He went to St. John's Prep, which it's on the North Shore of Boston. It's a Catholic boys prep school here, highly competitive both academically and athletically. And Pete continued to play all three sports all 4 years there, which is quite a feat, and also made the National Honor Society. So he was a student athlete in every sense of the word. He also was the captain of almost all the teams he was on. So he was and still is a very intelligent, bright, articulate, charismatic person with an ability to lead with amazing kindness and with an amazing work ethic and by example. Mm-hmm. So he was recruited for football and for baseball going to college, and he decided to go to my husband, my daughter's alma mater, Boston College. And he went on to play baseball at BC while keeping up the rigorous academics there. And he captained the team his senior year. He did not get drafted, unfortunately, for Major League Baseball. So he went to Europe and played professionally at in Hamburg, Germany, mm-hmm. came home, decided that life was, needed to kickstart his life. The dream of going to the major leagues wasn't going to happen, mm-hmm. and got a corporate job in Boston and continued to play baseball at night. And in a very high-level league. So it was guys who had moved on from the dream but still had baseball running through their veins. Mm-hmm. So a pretty high level. And in the summer of 2011, in the summer of 2010, Pete was batting about 400 and hitting home runs all over Boston. Wow. In the summer of 2011, Pete barely could hit the ball. He was hitting about 200. And at the end of the season, he got hit in the wrist on a fast pitch, which normally he would whack out of the stadium. So that was in August of 2011. So for the next 6 months, he was going to doctors in Boston. He was living there. He was a 27-year-old kid. And on March 13th, 2012, he asked my husband and to us to go to the doctors with him because he said he found a doctor who knew what was wrong with his wrist. Mm-hmm. And we walked into the neurologist's office at Beth Israel, and he looked right at my son and said, "I don't know how to tell a 27-year-old this, but you have ALS." And we become a cliche at that point in time. Our lives changed in a second. Mm-hmm. And the diagnosis was incredibly traumatizing because as I reflect on it, I thought, what did I actually know about ALS in this moment? Mm-hmm. And what I knew in that moment was that I knew it was bad, and I knew that Lou Gehrig was 75 years ago. And honestly, that was just about it. So I turned and looked at the doctor, and then I said, okay, here's ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Okay, I get that. Now tell me, what's the treatment and what's the cure? And that's when the second blow hit. And the doctor said, I'm sorry to tell you, Mr. and Mrs. Frates, but we've made virtually no progress against this disease. There's no treatment and there's no cure, and the prognosis is 2 to 5 years.
Wow.
I'm not exactly sure when I tell the story which was more devastating, the actual diagnosis, or the fact that then the doctor turns to you and literally tells you there is nothing you can do and, oh, we don't need to see you again for another 3 months and don't stop at the pharmacy on the way home because there's nothing we're going to give you. Mm-hmm. So that started the ALS story. Mm-hmm. That evening, my daughter came and son-in-law came home from New York. My younger son, Andrew, came home from Boston, and Pete went and picked up his girlfriend at the time, Julie, and we were all sitting around the kitchen table, and that's when Pete had the vision, literally 6 hours after he had been given that diagnosis at 27 years old.
Wow.
And he said his exact words. He talked to us just like we were his new team. He said, okay, people, there'll be no whining. He goes, strap it on. This is our new team. He said, we're not looking backwards. We're looking forward, which in of itself, it now being 3 years into this, is amazing because a lot of people in this disease tend to wallow in the why me. Mm-hmm. And it is very, you can totally, very understandable. But he said, we're not going to ask why me. why not me? He said, we're gonna move forward with this. He said, and I'm going to change the trajectory of the disease. It's unacceptable. And that's exactly what he said. He said, this is completely unacceptable. He said, I'm going to get the disease in front of philanthropists such as Bill Gates. Mm-hmm. And that was the origin of our journey. And so that's Pete's story up to ALS and setting the vision for the next 3 years of our life.
He's an amazing person. He is an absolutely amazing
person. An amazing
person.
Family.
Thank you for sharing that. He showed these leadership qualities from a young age. Maybe that contributed to that kind of an attitude that he wasn't going to look back.
Oh, and being an athlete his whole life. You know, when you're an athlete, there, you know, discipline, level of responsibility, you know, the self-discipline, self-motivation, and when you're up against challenges, you are, you know, it's all up to you to self-motivate yourself to take on a challenge. And how, you know, it's a big, especially baseball, very mental game. Mm-hmm. You're up at that plate all by yourself. So his mental toughness, we always knew he had incredible mental toughness. And he exhibited again that night. But his leadership qualities were evident at a young age, and he continued to just build on those skills over the years and develop into a true leader.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nancy, on the Ice Bucket Challenge, what was the thought process behind this idea? And, I mean, if there's ever anything that showed the power and expanse of social media, it has mm-hmm. been the Ice Bucket Challenge.
Oh, absolutely. So what I tell people, you know, everybody wants to talk about social media and the fact that people were pouring ice water over their heads. And, yes, those were definitely elements of this. But the root of the organic nature of it was relationships, people to people. Mm-hmm. So when Pete was diagnosed, the next day we started creating Team Freight Train. And what happened was we called it the Circles of Pete. Every team that Pete had ever been on, every classmate, coworker, he had led with kindness and, like I said, example. And when everybody heard about this diagnosis, he basically used the same words with every person when he called them. Because what happened, what unfolded over the next couple of days and in the following weeks was that Pete had been hiding his symptoms from us. Mm. He already had a foot drop and had lost the use of his left hand almost completely. And, of course, he lived in Boston, so we didn't basically see it. So he was literally in the throes of the disease almost on the day of diagnosis, which is not unusual for ALS. It's a long process to get a correct diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So what happened was we started the next day calling everybody, and he told us, he said, you tell every single person I have this disease and come fight with us. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. Mm-hmm. So over the next 3 years, we created Team Freight Train. At the same time, Pete became very good friends with other ALS, I call them the young guns of ALS, younger people who were diagnosed with this disease, who were really working at doing something about it. So Steve Gleason in New Orleans, who's from the Seattle area, Kevin Swan, O.J. Bergantz. And since Pete's diagnosis, there have been a couple of other young guns of ALS that Pete has helped mentor. And what basically he would say to them was, start your communities. Start building your community. So Pat Quinn out on New York was diagnosed about a year after Pete. And Pete did the same thing. He helped him build Quinn for the Win, which is what he calls his supporters. So all these young guns all have their supporters. So Pat Quinn was on his Facebook feed at the end of July last year, and he sees someone pouring ice water over their head for ALS. But what happened was the ice bucket challenge in and of itself, the actual activity, had been going around for different causes in June and July of last year, 2014, in the summer. And nothing really caught on. It was just throwing it here, throwing it there. And there was a golfer who had it thrown to him. He actually has a cousin in New York with ALS. So he poured water over his head and said, "This is for ALS," and sent it up to New York. This young man, the cousin, lives in the town next door to Pat Quinn. So when they had mutual neighbors. So when Pat Quinn actually saw it, he called Pete. And he said, "Pete, I think I found the vehicle." Because they knew they had been building momentum in different parts. So the two of them started to strategize. And Pat got his supporters and started getting it going through his supporters. And Pat's supporters actually, Pat has family that live in Ireland. So it got to Ireland very quickly through Pat. Pete, on the other hand, we had 3,500 Facebook followers before the Ice Bucket Challenge. And Pete had an incredibly strong network, the Boston College Network, the St. John's Prep Network, and all of his baseball teams and football and hockey teams, all those networks Pete started. Now, Pete, at this point, the disease had progressed to the point where he couldn't talk any longer. So what he did is, using his iGazer technology, he started shooting emails to people of influence that he knew, one being Matt Ryan, the quarterback of the Atlanta Falcons, who was a good friend of him, is at Boston College. So Pete knew that if he could get it to the professional athletes that he knew with a lot of followers, then it would just, and made sure that they said it was for ALS, for Pete Frates. And then we started telling people through Facebook and social media to use the hashtag ALS Ice Bucket Challenge or Strikeout ALS. And basically, it was like that old natural organic shampoo commercial, and so on and so on and so on. But those first 3-4 days were very strategic. We got on social media and started engaging. And it was Pete directed all of this. And he said, "I want you to like, share, and comment every Ice Bucket Challenge that comes through."
Wow.
So what he wanted to do is, he just wanted to reinforce to people that we were thanking them, that we were so grateful that they were doing it, and that we cared. And so I tell this story when I give speeches, that there was about 8 of us, my husband, myself, and our sisters and brothers, sitting around a table like on the third day at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon in our pajamas with a couple of bottles of wine. And finally, just threw our hands up in the air and said, "Yeah, we can't do this anymore. It's kind of gotten a little bit bigger than we can like, comment, and share." So that honestly is the insight into the actual first couple of days. By the fourth day, the Boston media had picked up on it, and then it just exploded. But the Boston College Network and the St. John's Prep Network, they were the ones that absolutely flew this thing out. And then, of course, then it got to the Boston sports teams. And when you start getting Patriots, Bruins, and Red Sox players doing it, then it just went nuts.
Yeah, it did.
And globally, Pete also sent it to Germany, where he still retains friendship from when he played baseball over there. So it really took off in Germany too. So it was definitely social media that was the vehicle that made this work. And to see social media work in such a positive and positive, life-changing way, it was just great.
It was miraculous. It really was. It was all over Facebook and Twitter. And
yep.
Now, it raised over $220 million, isn't that right?
Globally. Yep, globally.
Yeah. What is, I'm curious about where that money is going to be spent or what needs to, because I guess I don't understand why, and maybe you probably didn't understand right why, you know, it was your initial question was about when he was first diagnosed, but why isn't there more? I mean, why don't they have a cure by now with as much exposure as Lou Gehrig's disease has had?
That's a great question, and that's exactly it. Why? Why don't you? And when you look at Dr. Bob Brown at UMass Medical Center, who is one of the leading researchers in ALS and has been working on it for 40 years, I mean, you look at this man, he is so brilliant, so dedicated, and so passionate. This disease is so complex. So ALS, to give you, so it's a brain disease that attacks the motor neurons that goes to your muscles. So the motor neurons actually die off, and that's the progression of it. You literally, in the person that has ALS, the journey is watching, they're called fasciculations. You can actually see them underneath the skin dying off. And so with my son Pete, it started with his lumbar functions, meaning the lower part of the spine. So it went to his extremities first. So he lost the use of his hands, then his feet, then his arms, then his legs. And then it went up his spine, and then it goes into, you know, the bulbar functions, your speaking, your swallowing, and eventually into your diaphragm, and your diaphragm will stop. So any muscle stops working except for the brain, the organ of the brain stays intact. So with ALS, first of all, onset is different. So some people, it starts in the top of the spine with the bulbar functions. I've met people who are on ventilators to keep them breathing, who are walking.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And my son was walking and talking and was completely paralyzed. Mm-hmm. So number one, onset is very different. Number two, progression is very different. Pete is at the final stage of ALS in the respect that he is now completely on machines to stay alive. He's on a ventilator. Whereas our friend Pat Quinn, who was diagnosed a year after Pete, only 1 year after Pete, is still walking, talking, breathing, eating, doing all that. Pete at that point was paralyzed and couldn't swallow. Mm-hmm. So there is not there are no two ALS patients that are alike.
Right.
So the disease is so complex and so elusive. But they really have found in the last 5 years, biomarkers, and they're doing a lot with the genome project to try to really nail this down. And there is, and when I talk to a Dr. Bob Brown, all I'm hearing is it is going to happen now. And the other piece is that, you know, a lot of neurologists don't tend to go into ALS. ALS is a very, if you can just think from a professional standpoint, you have to be so dedicated because, first of all, you're never delivering good news, ever. Mm-hmm. And second of all, you are constantly battling this beast of a disease that keeps, you know, throwing curveballs at you. So we've made a promise for the researchers, those at ALS-TDI, which is another research organization up here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the ALS Association, and all the doctors that are working in all the hospitals in their research, that we will not stop and we will continue to fund them and continue to get people to come into this field so that this will end.
Nancy, have they found any geographical and or environmental link to ALS?
None that has any data to support it.
Okay.
They do have pockets where it seems to have a higher incidence. But I do have to be perfectly honest with you. This disease is still quite misunderstood. There are people, numbers, let's talk numbers. So they say at one time in the United States, 30,000 people have the disease at one time. Mm-hmm. But qualifying that, every 90 minutes, someone is diagnosed with ALS. Every 90 minutes, someone dies of ALS. So we have a stagnant number of 30,000, mm-hmm. which is puts us in the rare disease, but they die within 2 to 5 years. So it's, you know, so that's a whole nother conversation. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that the symptoms can be misdiagnosed. So we feel that there are a number of people who are misdiagnosed. Lyme disease has a lot of the same kind of, you know, people lose their ability to use their hands, their legs, sometimes their speech. As a matter of fact, as soon as Pete was diagnosed, the next thing that was done is we were sent to an infectious disease doctor to make sure he did not have Lyme disease. It's a cruel diagnosis. We have met people in parts of the country where doctors might not have quite the same bedside manner. And literally when they said, what's the treatment, what's the cure, they're looked at and they're said, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. Go home and get your things in order. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people just kind of leave the doctor's office. And it's a very humbling and frightening diagnosis. And there's no reason to go back to the doctor.
Right.
Other than symptomatic.
That wasn't your case, though, it doesn't sound like.
We keep going back to the clinic. We support our clinic very much. We support all the ALS organizations. We are totally entrenched. We've been entrenched in the community since day two when Pete said, okay, we got to get to know the players. We got to get to know who's doing the research, who's on the cutting edge, where the money needs to go. Those are the kind of things that we did as a family immediately. So I'm now on the National Board of Trustees of the ALS Association, mm-hmm. of the National Association. So we went another way, and that was with Pete's leadership. Because believe me, as his mother, I could have very easily just cowered under my own fear. Mm-hmm. But my son would not expect that of me and demanded differently of me.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was reading about your journey, I was interested to read the expense that's involved, and something a lot of people don't think of. I know I hadn't thought of it, but about $280,000 per year to live with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because believe this or not, Medicare does not cover caregiving for ALS patients.
Wow.
When Pete was in the hospital, my whole family we're all business people. Not one of us went into medicine. None of us have the stomach to go into medicine. And they told us that we had to learn how to suction his trach because family members have to learn, because most families take their vented, paralyzed, non-communicative patient home without any skilled help.
Unbelievable.
Now, we have been fortunate in that we have an amazing community and we have amazing supporters that have been fundraising for Pete so that our family literally will not go bankrupt. But I can tell you that's when we really start working, is when we hear of people who are literally losing their homes or they have to quit their jobs and then they lose their own health insurance because they have to stay home and care for people.
Right.
This disease,
that's so wrong.
It hits a family. So just think of the mental, emotional. Now, Pete is at a point where he needs 24-hour care. Because he can no longer, when I say he can't swallow, that doesn't just mean his food. That means his saliva. So his saliva has to be suctioned out of his mouth almost every minute. And so if you can't get help in, and you're in a situation where it's just you and your spouse and your caregiver, it is a 24-hour job. He can't roll over in bed. If he gets uncomfortable, he has to be physically moved. So the physical, mental, emotional toll that this puts on a family is incomprehensible. And then to throw on the financial toll, it is the cruel. It is so cruel. And like I said, for our family, we're fortunate that we can keep battling on because we are just so fueled by the families that we're in contact with that we will change this.
Nancy,
I believe
are more government officials getting involved with this?
Yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, good news today, now the Steve Gleason Act, if anybody wants to go on Google and pull it up, right before I was talking to you, I just had a little sob session here myself in my office that it was passed by the Senate today. Medicare, in all its wisdom, was going to take away paying for communication devices for ALS patients. Because
I had heard
that they were playing video games on them. Now, who in their right mind even thinks like that? But we won't even get into that. So you're talking about completely locked-in patients, and Medicare is going to take away the only way they can communicate to the outside world. Never mind tell a caregiver or a doctor that something is going wrong with them. But we've been working with the Gleason, Team Gleason. The whole ALS community has been working diligently. All the organizations, the advocacy arms of all the organizations, and just today, the Senate passed the act, which means now that Medicare will continue to cover it.
Oh, good.
But that's great
news. That's such a year of frightening people.
Yeah.
Of absolutely frightening people that the thought that it wasn't going to be covered.
Crazy.
Nancy, Linda and I have been involved with our local ALS association, and of course we've followed this for the last year. Well, it needs, you know, the story needs to be out there. And the one thing I've really noticed, again, with our Evergreen Association is, and I think all of them, is how supportive emotionally and financially these people are and dedicated. And, you know, they work, it's a bare bones situation with a lot of these people. So that's why I think after the success of the Ice Bucket Challenge, so many people think there's so much money, and there isn't. It's so much is going to research. These employees are working bare bones, and their hearts are with you. And most of the people that work for this association have someone that has had ALS in their family. So they live it. They know it.
Absolutely. Yeah, once this disease touches you, it never lets go of you. So you are absolutely right. We have 39 chapters throughout the country, and I've had the honor of meeting more than half of them. And you're totally right. Most of the people that work there, they're not going to get rich off of working there, but their passion and their dedication is because most of them have been touched by it. But that's why, and I'll tell you and Linda right now, the Ice Bucket Challenge is coming back at you in August.
Good.
$220 million, just to put it in perspective, drug development takes over $1 billion to bring a drug from research to market. It's a billion-dollar proposition. We don't even have a drug that we... So ours is still caught, like you said, ours is in research, but it's also in care services. We are trying to beef up our loan closets because that's one thing that the ALS Association does. Is they have, you know, our association is three pronged. It's advocacy, which like we did, we worked on the Gleason Project and other legislative issues that affect ALS patients and the FDA. The second is care services, and that's exactly it. That's going out to homes to help ALS patients to try to get them the equipment that they need to give them emotional services, social services, And the third prong is research. And, you know, having the research dollars to help fund research in ALS. So we, $220 million sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money. But in the world of medicine and drug development, and especially for a disease that has been underfunded for so long, we've made big promises to these researchers. You don't worry about the money anymore. The patient community is saying, we're going to keep doing it now so that we can keep the money coming to you so that you can get this happening a lot quicker.
Well, good for you. Good for you. And, yep. And it's one thing that I think that it has done, it is a lot of money, not nearly enough, but it certainly, I think, has helped the people, the grassroots organizations that have been struggling along, trying to raise money all this time and, you know, not being real successful. I think it's given everybody hope that there is a way, if you use social communication properly and enough passionate people get involved, there is hope to raise a lot of money for this cause.
Well, exactly. And the major disruptor that came out of the whole thing, the major disruptor of philanthropy, is that the ALS Association has reported that 55% of their money came from 18 to 30-year-olds. That is an enormous disruptor. The fact that 18 to 30-year-olds, you know, the instant gratification selfie generation, dip their toes in the world of philanthropy.
Exactly.
So, and that's not just good for ALS. That is good for
everybody. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Everybody. So, and we know, as a matter of fact, I've been having conversations with other disease communities, that a lot of people saw an uptake in August of last year in different diseases, because people who were greatly affected by heart disease might have, you know, poured water over, they had sent their donation to the Heart Association.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that they told me, because we know in ALS, and we expected it in ALS, was that our fall events and our winter events, all the numbers and participations were way up. And I said, I've talked to other diseases who said the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it put philanthropy back in the minds of people.
Good.
And I think what it did, it made people, the thing that I always say about the Ice Bucket Challenge is that Pete's story and Pat's story and then the other ALS patient stories, they were so relatable and compelling. Mm-hmm. Our story was so relatable. We're just middle-class people working like dogs, working to educate our kids towards retirement. You know, we have a kid who happens to be a gifted athlete, doing unbelievable things. We ride that wave, and our world changes in a second.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people said, "Wow, you know what? It was much more personal." And like you said, it was so grassroots that mm-hmm. the story just kept telling it over and over again. And like I said, and now ALS, the renewed hope and the renewed joy in the community is the fuel that keeps us going.
Mm-hmm.
We have heard so many stories from other ALS patient families that, you know, their patient, all of a sudden, people were talking about their disease because nobody talked about it. And I go back to that moment that the doctor told me that my son had ALS, and what I knew was two things. And I figured that's what most people know. That's all they know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know the reality. That was the thing that Pete said. I'm going to be out there. I'm going to document my journey. I want people to see mm-hmm. what this disease does. And mm-hmm. once you see it, you can't walk away from it.
Mm-mm. Well, I'm very, very sorry that you're in this position now to be the spokesperson, but I'm very, very thankful to you and Pete and the whole freight train team, everybody who's out there that's turning what is a very horrible thing into something good for other people. I'm very thankful to you and to Pete.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure. And I was out at the Evergreen chapter about a month ago, and it is an amazing chapter with amazing people working there. So you're very lucky in that part of the country to have such caring, compassionate people that are working in the field of ALS.
We certainly thank you, Nancy.
Nancy, where can they go to, our listeners, to kind of keep up with your work and Pete's journey and, you know, and really get the information they need to join this, especially since it's going to be a 2015 Ice Bucket Challenge?
Sure. So the best two places to go is Pete's website, which is PeteFrates.com. And that tells Pete's story and things that we're doing. The other place is on Facebook, the Team Freight Train page, TEAMFRATETRAIN, Team Freight Train. And because we are constantly posting, such as the Steve Gleason Act, all three prongs, research, advocacy, patient services, and what Pete is doing and what he's been up to. Pete has been, and our family have received a lot of honors. And, you know, I'm sure you know Pete was up for Time Man of the Year with Pat Quinn a couple of weeks ago. He was number 19 of Fortune Magazine's 50 Global Leaders. Mm-hmm. Got the Inspiration Award at the Sports Illustrated Awards. His ESPN video, if you go on YouTube, you can look at, it's called Pete Challenge. It's a SportsCenter ESPN video about Pete. It has now been nominated for an Emmy. So there is, and what we every time, and there are plenty more. He was Communicator of the Year, so PR Week. But every time, all we keep saying is that people will just be reading more about ALS and hearing more about ALS. So the momentum continues. We're incredibly proud of our son, how he's handled this challenge. But spiritually, my spirit has so much joy in it because I know that Pete was chosen for this. And that little boy that led at age 5, he was being groomed to lead, and the world decided that ALS needed him, and that helps get me through my day.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pete is a champion in every possible way, and the world's a better place because of him. And yes,
you're a great family.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me,
Nancy.
Nancy Frades, and you can find more about them at their website. Our next guest is going to be Becky Moore, and she's the executive director here in our town of Spokane, but she's like so many directors of these chapters where they have local hands-on needs for money and volunteers, and they're fundraising, and they're just doing the grassroots kind of stuff. So her story, her experience is the same as all the other ones in the United States, all these other chapters of the ALS Association.
They work hard. It's really interesting, Linda, and I have been involved with the Evergreen chapter. And so many of the people that are involved have been impacted by this disease. And their story is, it's just an incredibly humbling story. It's such a tough disease. And like Becky will inform us, you know, finally it's getting out what this disease is all about, and again, the need for a cure. But they're both very, very interesting interviews, and I hope people will become even more aware and get involved.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways you can get involved, and we're going to talk to Becky about that. It's not just about money. It's also about volunteering. And so whatever you can do to help out, and I know we all have a lot of things that, you know, philanthropic causes that we have, but there's so many needs in our world. It doesn't hurt to do two or three or four, because I know a lot of times it's the same group of people who are doing everything. But if everyone was to pitch in and not just say, well, I just have this one thing that I do, but maybe have three or four or five, or, you know, just really let that be your ministry in life, then we could really help. We could help get a lot of these kinds of things done and not put the burden on one or two people. Well, okay, let's go ahead and just get the interview going with Becky, and then we'll find out from her what these needs are and how you can help. All right, Janie and I are here with Becky Moore. She's the Executive Director of the ALS Association's Evergreen Chapter right here in Spokane. Welcome to the show, Becky.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.
Welcome, Becky.
So are you enjoying the sunshine we're having today?
Oh, my gosh. It's so beautiful. I can't even believe it.
It's like we live in a different state, isn't it?
Exactly.
Well, Becky, we've been talking to Nancy Frates today and really trying to understand what the needs are of the ALS patients, and she gave us a good amount of information. Now, this is the local chapter, and so what we're wondering is, when it comes down to, you know, the local chapters, what kind of things do you provide for the ALS patients that come to you?
That's a great question. You know, we provide absolutely anything that we can. Primarily, we do equipment loans free of charge for people with ALS. Typically, as the disease progresses, people need more and more medical equipment. And quite frankly, insurance doesn't always cover some of the basic things that people need, like, well, I don't know, something as simple as a bath bench so that they can bathe comfortably, a certain kind of pillow so that they can be comfortable reading, just all kinds of things. That's our first priority. And then we also have care coordinators who go out into the homes, help people connect up with other resources that are available to them, like maybe Medicare, the VA, other local charitable organizations that might provide things that we don't. So we just do whatever we can to fill in the gaps for a person's care.
Becky, I want to ask you the approximate numbers of ALS patients in the Northwest at this time.
So, yeah, that's a great question. Last year, for Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Alaska, our chapter served about 568 patients. Wow. And we know we're reaching maybe about 80% of the patients living with ALS. So there's other folks out there that either don't know that we exist or that somehow don't need our services. So,
now, Becky, it's a disease that is so often misdiagnosed as either MS or Lyme disease, and so it's quite a process to find out if you are indeed an ALS patient.
That's correct, and one of the things we do, we're involved with an ALS clinic here in Spokane, as well as an ALS certified center of excellence in Seattle and other ALS clinics through the VA and it's Swedish. And part of that is because it helps keep ALS on the radar of the neurologists and people who are diagnosing patients and seeing patients, so that they look for ALS and so that goes faster, because you can imagine how frustrating that is. Some people have had surgeries and undergone all kinds of unnecessary things through the process of being diagnosed.
Wow.
Now, Becky, being that, of course, this show comes out of Spokane, Washington, with our affiliation with the Evergreen Chapter, this Spokane-based clinic is new, isn't it?
It is new. It's with Rockwood, with a neurologist there, Dr. Scott Carlson, who's now seeing ALS patients in conjunction with a team of professionals. What it means to have an ALS clinic like that is that the patient can come in, and instead of having to have a different appointment with a physical therapist, with a speech pathologist, with other disciplines that could help them, they get to see them all at once on one day on a clinic visit.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a lot easier for patients, particularly as the disease progresses and they become more and more disabled. You can imagine how difficult it is for a patient to get, you know, all ready to go and in a wheelchair and driven someplace and having to do, you know, 20 appointments when they can just get it sort of one-stop shopping.
Mm-hmm. Becky, how did you get involved with ALS? Did you have anyone in your family with it?
I did, actually. My involvement came in 1994 when my brother-in-law was diagnosed with ALS. So this is very personal to me. We're very fortunate. Typically, ALS progresses for 2 to 5 years from prognosis to when a person passes away. But we've been fortunate in that my brother-in-law actually has a slower progression of the disease, much like Stephen Hawking's, and is still with us some 20 years later.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what does the Evergreen chapter need? Volunteers, money, you know, what kind of things are you looking at that you would like to ask the community for support in?
I would say all of the above. You know, we love having people come out and volunteer at our events. We're coming into some events in the fall. We'll be doing a walk in Spokane, and we've got a bike ride coming up in June in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. So we just love having people come out and volunteer for us. And obviously the funding, you know, we just direct as much as we can towards our patients. And we also have been giving a portion of money directly to ALS research on the chapter level. So that's all to the good.
You know, Becky,
we have a website. I can tell everybody our website. It's ALSA-EC for evergreenchapter.org to keep it local.
I thought it was really important when we did the interview in regard to the $220 million that was brought in from the Ice Bucket Challenge. I think so often people assume that ALS has so much funding, and they don't, because just exactly what you said, it goes to the families to help compensate for the tremendous costs that are involved and for research. And so it's important to keep the ball moving on this. And I know you guys are getting ready for this year, this summer's Ice Bucket Challenge again.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. We've heard from, and I'm sure Nancy told you this, from the patients that they really want to kick it off again in August, which would be great. I got to tell you, the public awareness has been wonderful too. Sort of beyond the funding, which the vast majority is going to directly to ALS research. Beyond that, though, the awareness for the patients to suddenly feel like they come out of a dark, dark closet into the light of day, where they can say, yes, I have ALS, and now people go, oh, I know what that is. I've heard of that, instead of, what the heck is that?
It's taken a long time.
From my perspective, yes.
You know hands-on.
Well, before it was Lou Gehrig's disease, and why do we call it ALS now and not Lou Gehrig's disease? Is there a reason for that, or...?
You know, we do have this sort of name confusion going on. A lot of people, you know, had attachment to Lou Gehrig and knew who he was, and that was just great awareness for the disease. But now I don't know how many people are really engaged with baseball or that. So, you know, I typically try to say ALS more than Lou Gehrig's disease. But
so it's,
you know,
almost a generational thing. Almost.
That could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering why. So what... So people can go, first of all, I should say, where can they go to donate money to ALS if that's what they want to do? Is it going to be the website?
The website's easy, and you can also call us at 866-STOP-ALS. So that's our toll-free line that's easy to remember. You know, if you want to help us stop ALS and help people living with the disease locally, you can do that as well.
Okay, and then I have one last question. What if... you know, if we are able to raise funds, and, you know, what kind of things are you looking to improve upon if you had the money locally?
Our biggest need is to help people with technology, and not, you know, most people lose the ability to speak as the disease progresses, but not everyone. Sometimes they lose the ability, they can still speak, but they can't move their hands. So ways to access people's environment, that has come to the fore. We did a survey last year, and patients have told us that is their biggest need. So we're trying very hard to get more devices, like, oh, something as simple as a foot mouse, when people can still move their foot, but maybe nothing else, and they could access their computer that way, or access environmental controls in their house. Anything like that, that's sort of techie ability, or even, you know, not such high tech, but helps people to access their environment better and to communicate with the people around them. That's kind of our focus this coming year, because patients want it and need it.
Mm-hmm. Becky, could you tell us a little bit about the Steve Gleason law that was just approved in the last week?
Oh, my goodness. That's a big one. Really great. It's passed the Senate, and it still needs to pass the House, but I don't think that's going to be too much of a problem. We're really grateful for Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers locally, who has championed this bill. And really what it does is Medicare at this point, when it pays for a speech-generating device, does so under a rental system. And as long as the device is rented from Medicare, if they switch to another form of care, like end up in a hospital or some other kind of facility, a nursing home or hospice house, that then they will take the device back. What most people don't understand is that it takes like 4 months to set up your device to be personal to you, to even be able to speak with your voice if you do voice banking. And so to start all over again with a new device that might or might not be provided by a hospital or care facility is really burdensome. Plus, they lock them down. They've locked them down so people can't access the internet or email or connect with other people that way, maybe through texting. And as we know now, today, in the modern world, people can email and text their healthcare providers. So this is just egregious. So this law will help to move the ball forward and allow people to access their environment and communicate like they should be able to.
Nice. Well, Becky, they can then, I'm going to reiterate this, look forward to a bike ride in June. And what's that going to be called?
It's the Ride to Defeat ALS out of Silver Valley, Idaho, in northern Idaho.
Okay, and they can go to the website to get information about that?
Correct, alsa-ec.org.
Okay, and then in fall you have a walk, and what's that going to be called?
The Walk to Defeat ALS,
walk
just keeping
defeat.
It simple there. Rider Walk to Defeat ALS, and that those come about in the fall, and we have them all over the region, and there is one in Spokane.
I have walked that walk before, Becky. It's very organized.
Great.
I like the walk idea. The ride, I'm not sure. How many miles is it? A mile, 2 miles, maybe. Now, what kind of a course is it?
It's on the lovely trail there that is really beautiful and easy. And, you know, you can go as far as you want to go and turn around and come back and just hang out for the party.
You can hang out
on
those big tunnels.
And just get people to sponsor you and then ride for to defeat ALS.
Exactly, and we have a great website that handles all of that. You can, it's pretty easy. You can even send emails out through it, and it's a lot of fun just to come and join the party. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's a good idea. Okay, so alsa.ec.org, and you can call to donate at 866-STOP-ALS. That's pretty easy to remember. Becky, thank you for coming on today.
We
and
support
best of luck
you, Becky,
with everything you're doing. Thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you guys so much for raising awareness and helping people.
Great
with
job, Becky.
It,
great job.
Well, enjoy that sunshine.
All right. I will. You too.
Thank you, Becky.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on Talk About with Rez and Andy, live every Monday at 3 p.m. Please join us next week for another great show. And please call in and share your thoughts and opinions. Also, look for us and like us on Facebook and Twitter, and follow our show page on BTR.